Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 24th, 2002. Gerard Fisher gives a session on reform of the criminal justice system with a focus on prison institutions from a Christian perspective. This is session number 2, Journey to Prison, Protesting the School of Americas and Life in Prison. This is tape number 2002-02. And now let's go to the fireside room for today's session.
Sisters and brothers in Christ, good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to in preparation for tonight, I'd like to just do a couple points that I tried to do yesterday, and that was the preparation for my journey. I called my life for the last 30 years a journey, which ended up in prison, and then in the next tomorrow I'm going to talk about criminal justice reform and prison reform. And yesterday I talked about my preparation as a youngster and so on, and then my many journeys to Central America, and then putting together the atrocities that were occurring all over Central and South America, and pointing to the School of Americas. But first, I'd like, as a segue, I'd like to talk about two stories which are about the people of El Salvador. First of the story is about their deep faith, which I found astounding, and also about their tremendous generosity. The first story is about a woman we met with in a restaurant, and we talked for a long time, and she told us that she would hope that in her lifetime peace would come to El Salvador. This was still while the war was on in 89. And she said, if it isn't in my time, at least in my children's time, but if it takes 100 years, God in his time will bring peace to Central and El Salvador especially. I mean, I found that she had lost her husband and one child in the war, and still she had that faith that God in his good time would bring peace to El Salvador. You know? I found that very striking. The other story is about generosity, and we, of course, many people have been there have said, you know, if they have one chicken left and you come, they do the chicken for you. And that we found that in my many journeys that they did everything they could to be hospitable to you. And these are people who are living on the edge of dying of hunger and then giving something away. The second story then is about a community which was in San Salvador. And it wasn't much more than three times the width of this room, and maybe 100 yards long, and it was on there was a ravine and a river down there, and then on this side was a street in San Salvador, and there was a fence there, and their houses were built up against that fence. Their houses, I say, their shacks, which were just, you know, whatever they could throw together, and everyone had a fire with a rice bowl. And that was continually going, and that's what they ate three times a day, except for a few bananas they had from the tree that was growing in their compound. And the military had bombed their place on numerous occasions, and there was holes, and they had to repair it as best they could. Well, the Lutheran Church was going to give them a gift, and they put together some building materials and some food and other things that they thought they required, you know. And so they told that they were sending this over. And these people had a little meeting, and they said, please send it to these other people. They just got here, and they're poorer than we are. And, you know, and these were people, I don't know how you get much poorer, but they were poor, but they thought that people who were just coming into the community would need the material more than they did. So that's my feelings about the people of not only El Salvador and all the countries I've been to, but I think that's probably, for at least for the poor people, is kind of a picture of Central and South America, that's the way people are there. And today I want to talk about two things, my journey to prison and a little bit about prison life. And I repeat, anytime you want to interrupt, just interrupt. If you've got something to add that I don't know, that you could make help everybody learn something, that would be fine. Or if you differ with me on anything about my political things, you be sure to say something and just jump right in. I won't be embarrassed or irritated by being interrupted. Well, first of all, I was always raised as a very In the family, of course, I told you, my father was very just and very, but it was also an orderly family. We voted in every election, and my father would not allow us to have any things that were against other people. So I grew up that way. And as an adult, I was law abiding in every manner. I never got a ticket for driving. I never, you know, this is the way I was growing up. You respect the law and you obey it. Well. I began my interest in El Salvador in the early 80s or the late 70s, and I had studied as much as I could about what was going on. And then we had the killings of the Jesuits, the seven teachers, professors, and their house worker and her daughter. They were slaughtered, some of them in their bed, some on the, and there was the person who was there, they were, and, I think the husband of the housekeeper, put roses every place where their bodies were. And so I was starting to put things together then about the atrocities in the SOA. And after they had a mass of remembrance for the Jesuits. Marquette is a Jesuit school, and they had Jesu is a very large church in Milwaukee, which is attached to the Marquette University. And they had a large service of many things. You know, the Jesuits weren't too concerned about SOA or anything else until this happened, and then of course they woke up and found out what they had been missing.
What is SOA?
School of America. Yeah,
okay.
Which has changed its name. But anyways, as we left, five of us did civil disobedience. We went out in the street. Wisconsin Avenue runs by. It's the busiest street to downtown. And five of us went on the street, knelt down, and started to pray. And of course, it took a while for the paddy wagon to get there, and they handcuffed us and took us away. That was one of my first times that I committed civil disobedience. But I began concentrating on the School of Americas because of what I was learning and because I felt it one of the very evils that I didn't want my tax money to go to. And as you know, the U.S. trained soldiers, if you don't know, that's what the SOA does. They train soldiers for other countries, and they say they're doing it because they want to instill democracy and human rights in these soldiers when they go back to their country. Well, as far as I can remember in my lifetime, I don't remember a war between two South American nations or two Central American nations. I don't remember that, at least. If I'm wrong, somebody correct me. So what were we training those soldiers for? I mean, Paraguay didn't have to protect itself from Uruguay. Certainly Nicaragua didn't have to protect itself from El Salvador, etc. So anyways, they kept training these soldiers, and a lot of things came out, especially the torture manuals that were exposed, in which they actually had gruesome ways to extract information from people, and they were teaching these soldiers. And the one course that almost everybody took was the commando course. And that had its repercussions, because that they were taught, and they became good killing machines. Many of these battalions became good killing machines. Well, anyways, I started to attend the vigils that were held outside of Fort Benning, which is in Columbus, Georgia. And at that time, there literally was a white line across the where you go in, a white line, and if you crossed that line and protested, then you were subject to arrest. Well, the first year we went, Lucy and I both went, and we both were arrested. There were 700 of us that crossed the line, and we were both arrested, and we were given ban and bar orders. Don't come back for 5 years or you're in real trouble. You know, that you were banned for 5 years and going onto the property. And what happens there, and it is highly attended. Lots of people come to Columbus for this. And Saturday, it's a big vigil. We have all kinds of people. We've had Native American groups from South America come, from some Inca dancers, and from all over the South and Central America, people came, even from Canada, and performed and danced and prayed. We had the Native Americans from the United States did a prayer service, and you know, the East, West, and South, and what they do, and drummed and so forth. And I remember Pete Seeger came, and he sang. And he said, when I could sing, nobody wanted my albums. Now that I can't sing, people are buying my albums. because you know, he's sort of famous, you know, and so people buy his albums. Anyways, in 1997, when I say both Lucy and I were arrested, and we went to, they took us in, by bus, they pick you up by buses, and they cart you wherever you want to put you, and they put us out in the field, and they and with a wall, and then they, I think this was training for the young soldiers on how to search people. So they put us all against the wall, women and men, and it's lots of women, too, also, you know, and they put us against the wall. Of course, there were women soldiers who frisked the women, but they took everything away from us. And the only thing we got back was a pen or a pencil, and that they took out and dumped on a corner in Columbus, and you could go and pick out and find your things, you know. But outside that, they took all the literature we had or anything else and destroyed it. So then, like I said, we were arrested, and we were photographed, and we were fingerprinted, and we sat down, and the person said, you have to sign this. So we signed it, and that said we could not come back for 5 years. Well, the next year was 1998, and we again, I should really say, though, Father Bourgeois, anybody who knows anything about the School of Americas knows Father Bourgeois. He was the first one. He protested by himself, who had great experiences in South America, in Bolivia, I believe, and other places, about living with the poor and understanding what was happening to them. And he got up in a tree with a megaphone, I believe, or a bullhorn, and he started to play a record of something, and it went all over the camp. And that was his way of protest. Of course, they came for him and had to bring him down from the tree, but that was the first time anybody was arrested, and he was arrested. He has spent like 3 or 4 years in prison, because he's been at almost for 10 years he's been at the vigil. Like I say, it's a happy occasion in a way, because there's so many people there. There's a lot of praying, a lot of singing, a lot of singing of hymns and so forth. And then at a given moment, somebody says, okay, now we're going, and all the people go across the line and march into Fort Benning. And in 1998, I think 2,000 people crossed the line, and they weren't ready for that. So when they picked us up, they put us in a bus, and they drove us out the other end of the camp and dropped us in a park, which was 3 or 4 miles from where we had come from. So we had to march all the way through a town back to where we were situated. So I should say one thing so I don't forget. You all know Peter Thompson? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Peter was our attorney. And he had done this pro bono work for 10 years. When ours was the last one, I believe, he acted in pro bono. But I can't say he was there to defend us, because we had no defense. We admitted to the fact, we knew what we were doing, we went across the line, and so on and so forth. So the next year, 1999, was the year that I again had to make a decision, would I cross, and then, because if I crossed and was arrested, I would certainly go to prison. So Lucy and I commiserated that in great extent. Of course, we didn't want us both to go, and I didn't believe that I wanted my wife to be put in prison. But so we, in our travels to the vigil that year, this was the year 1999, we sat in the car and commiserated with each other, should I do it? Now, of course, I had already decided I was going to do it. I wouldn't have backed out. Because I believe, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, there's a time when you have to stand fast. I mean, you can talk. You can talk, and you can say, oh, that school, you know, I'd do anything to close that school, except I don't want to go to prison. So you know, I think that's something that everybody has to challenge themselves. And I don't mean prison. I mean, there's other things people do that are just as justifiable and just as good. Prison is just one way some people express their interest in what they're doing and their anger over what they're experiencing as far as this school goes. So in 1999, there were 14,000 people there. 14,000 people in front of this gate, and all the way down the block, and down this block, and down this block, and all over the place. You can imagine on streets how many, you can fill a lot of streets with 14,000 people. And there were people there this high, little kids that were there. There were elderly people, and there were a lot of people in wheelchairs. The people in wheelchairs were all pushed across and joined the breaking of the law by crossing the line. But 5,000 people crossed the line. It took 2.5 hours for all the people to cross the line. That's how big that group was. And I was part of what they called a high-risk group. 50 of us were pointed out to be in the front of the group. And we dressed in black shrouds. and white death masks, and we carried coffins. And this was in commemoration for the thousands of people who have died by the hands of the SOE graduates. And the names of all the people, it took over two hours to name just the people we knew. You know, they would say, Maria, age 4, Presente, and everybody would yell Presente. And that went on. We could hear it while we were marching, you know. But it went on for time, person after person. And if you hear that, it just sends shivers up your back. And so many children who were died, you know, 7, 8, 5, 3 months old, one child died at the hands of an SOE graduate. These are all proven. I mean, they're open evidence, you know. Anyways, we began the march, and like I say, we crossed the line, and then they always let you march a while. And we went around the bend, and there they're waiting in the buses, you know. And when we saw them, we prostrated ourselves and put the coffins down and poured imitation blood on us. And the pictures that they've taken of us is pretty illustrative of what it must be when people are massacred. You know, there they were, you know, all strewn out, and 50 people all bleeding, and you know, and on the coffins in some cases, on the ground. And it was a moving thing for all the people behind us, and for the newspaper, especially in Columbus, had a big picture of it and so forth. Anyways, the 50 of us were the only ones arrested. And they took us I make a habit, a lot of people will make them carry you. I'm a nonviolent person. I have a sense that there's some violence in having two policemen maybe hurt their back carrying, especially if you weigh over 200 pounds, and have them carry me. So, and there was other people even heavier than I was. I said, you know, it's not fair. These policemen, they're military police, and they're only doing their job. They're commanded to pick us up and take us in. So when they picked me up, I went with it, and my good friend Joyce Alwanger and I marched together very slowly to the bus. You know, they were kind of making it go a little faster. You know, we walked slowly to the bus in our face masks and shrouds. And then they took us to a hangar, and they had probably one whole wall was for Polaroid pictures. So they could take our picture, and of course they fingerprinted us again, and then we sat down at a desk and they went through their files and they found out who was banned, who was there, you know, when they weren't supposed to be. So out of the 50, only 23 were second timers or banned people, so they were the only ones that were contested here. The rest were let go. And then of those, they picked 10. I don't know why they picked 10, but I was one of the 10. I was had the report for to court in Columbus to be prosecuted, and it was again. I have done a lot of CDs up to that time, but I've never done one where I was facing 6 months in a minimum security prison and a $5,000 fine. And so you think about that. And so I went home and I had a report to the trial, and it was an interesting fact. Up till that time, and I can't think of the judge's name.
Were you prosecuted in federal court?
Yeah, this was a federal offense. Yeah. In Columbus, Georgia, there's a courthouse, and that's where we were prosecuted. Up till that time, and I don't know, I can't remember the judge's name, but we call him the hanging judge. he gave everybody who appeared up to that time maximum penalties, and the maximum is 6 months and $5,000 fine, and he did not allow people to testify. If they wanted to talk about the fact why they did it, oh no, you can't do that. And he considered himself a Southern gentleman. And so for our people, for people before that, he always said to the women, well, I can't do a Southern accent, nor do I want to. But he said, I don't want to send you women to prison, you know, so I'll give you probation. Of course, the women would have no part of that. They wanted to be treated exactly the way the men were. And most of us wanted to go to prison. That was part of what we were, you know, that would be the only way we could demonstrate to the world and to our country, our city, and so forth, why we were doing this. Well, this judge that had been doing that, and I can't remember his name, was over 90 years old. And he had a stroke. But he did not resign. He wanted to wait till Bush became president so Bush could have another Republican on the bench, you know. But anyways, he could not do the trial, so a trial judge, Judge Lawson from Macon, which is north of Georgia, northern part of Georgia, and he came down and was a judge. And we were very fortunate because he allowed us to testify. We testified over 3 hours, the 10 of us, you know, one after another, as long as we wanted. He sat there and listened. He did not look out the window. He didn't yawn or, you know, go back in his chair. He sat on, in his chair upright and looked. Of course, you know, when the judge is here and you're testifying right here, he looked right in the eyes of the people who were testifying. And he said, "I have never been to a trial like this in my whole life," he said, and he's been on the bench for 22 years, that were, you know, a lot of the stuff came out. And I testified and everybody else testified. I spoke about my past, how I came to this point, and what I felt about the School of Americas. You know, and everybody had a different perspective on it. Well, there's, if you like, there's our testimony. They do it every year. They bind it, and if you're interested, you can read how we testified. But I would have to say that the other nine folks, and I don't include me, myself in that, but the other nine folks were the salt of the earth. We had one man, Charlie Littke. I don't know if you know of him. He was a Vietnam veteran. He was a priest in the war in Vietnam, and he got the Medal of Honor. He hauled I don't know how many wounded soldiers out of a sort of a foxhole on his back through enemy fire, I think 22 times. And he received the Medal of Honor. He was no longer a priest when he was with us, but nobody ever wanted to send him to prison. And whenever he went up for a trial, because of his Medal of Honor, that they were a little hesitant to give him the publicity that would happen if, well, Medal of Honor is arrested, you know. So he didn't, and he was very, he defended himself. And he was very uptight about it. He wanted to be arrested, and he wanted to be convicted. And the judge granted him that and gave him a year. And a $10,000 fine. And so anyways, another person that was one of the 10 was a New Mexico Woman of the Year. She had been a social worker who had done things with children and others and incest and the whole bit. She had a very long history and stuck it out for over 11 years. And she was voted the Woman of the Year in New Mexico. We had two pastors. One was a Methodist pastor, one of the most gentle souls you'd ever want to run across. His buddy said, "I don't know how he's going to do. He can, you know, he can hardly talk about anything. I mean, he's very tender-hearted, and he was one of them. And then the other one was an ELCA pastor from Minneapolis, who was also arrested. And then the other people were mostly people that were social workers or something in that vein. Most of the people who were arrested, 10, and all of them had a tremendous record and of achievement. And this was an impressive thing for the judge too. I should say I'm a retired pharmacist. I had a pharmacy for 25 years.
How come you didn't have a jury trial?
Well, I don't know if they would grant us that. I guess I don't know what the rules are, but nobody has ever had a jury trial who was ever brought before a judge.
The School of Americans.
Excuse me? Yeah, nobody's ever had a jury trial.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Civil disobedience, you can get a jury trial.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It wasn't, we were very fortunate, like I said. We were able to testify, and we got our message across to this judge, and he said, and like I said, I've never had a trial like this. And then when Attorney Thompson defended us, first of all, the prosecutor pointed out that we knew what we were doing, we crossed the line, and da-da-da, and he told all these things. And then the judge looked at to Peter, and he said, "What do you say?" And he said, "Amen." He said, "What?" He says, "I agree. That's what happened. Our defendants all knew what they were doing, and they went ahead anyway." And so that, he said, that's another one of those things I've never had in my court before, where the defendant attorney agrees with the prosecutor. But anyways, we were all sentenced. They had a long discussion, and he brought in the attorney, and he said, "I can't give these people maximum penalties." He said, they've touched me a little bit. And so he cut our sentences in half. He gave us 3 months and a $2,500 fine instead of the 6 years and the $5,000. And that was nice. He even suggested he might give us probation. And of course, we wouldn't accept that. But it wouldn't hurt. And at the time, I thought, "Oh, no, I want to do the whole six." You know? But when I was there 3 months, I was glad to get home. You know, it isn't as exciting as you think it is. But anyways, that was an interesting fact is that the people who have been sentenced, and again, there were 43 people arrested this last year, and of those, six were students, Quaker students, who were there to visit the school. And there's a fence now. You can't just walk across. You have to go way around and sneak in. So the rest of them snuck in, and they got swept up with these other folks, and they were all arrested, including the six innocent people. And they actually had to go to trial. Of course, then the evidence came out, and they were taken off. But almost everybody got 6 months, or in a couple cases, 3 months. And again, one person got a year because they had done it once before. So, but it's still going on, and the things, I don't know if you know about the SOA, but it's usually the countries where there's the greatest problem. When it was in El Salvador, then all of Salvadorans went up there, all the officers. And as I mentioned yesterday, Monterosa Colonel, who was guilty of the Almazote massacre, he went there, and it was, and now, guess who are the most soldiers who go to SOA at this point in history?
Colombia,
yeah. The vast majority of the people who are being trained are from Colombia, for a good reason. And I was talking to somebody who's going to visit there, or have visited. Some of you have been to Colombia, and it is the biggest export from Colombia is oil. They have the highest reserves of unused oil in Colombia of all, I guess, the whole hemisphere. And tell them the story about the woman. Go ahead.
It's a funny story. Some people heard it yesterday. A friend of ours was to Colombia, and when she came back, she gave a talk to a group like this, but they were all people of supportive nature. And she asked the same question Gerhard did and got the answer, well, it's drugs, isn't it? You know, what's the reason we're interested? And Joyce said, no, it's oil. Oil. And people there were kind of savvy. They knew pretty much about it. But this one kind of savvy woman in the back row pipes up. She says, what the hell is our oil doing under their rainforest?
Yeah, what the hell is their oil doing, our oil doing under their country? But anyways, that's where they go. And when they need soldiers to be trained to again, as I mentioned yesterday, the purpose is to make it easy for our multinationals to exist, because there's no unionization, there's no ecological things that they have to take care of, the wages are subhuman, so everything is protected by the military, and that keeps going on. And I don't know if you know much about Colombia, just a couple points. I don't know if we have time for this, but they're spraying there for the coca, and they use Roundup by DuPont. And then they add all kinds of other very difficult things, you know, and they spray this on these big fields. And of course, the workers are out there, and it goes on them. They get all kinds of diseases, and things break out. They have scabs and everything else. And many of them even die, because this is a very, you know, ground. You wouldn't want to be sprayed by Roundup, at least in any quantity. And this is even worse. So anyways, that's going on there, and we have given $1.3 billion for the military there, and of course they have all the helicopters and everything else like we had in El Salvador, which caused that war to extend itself a long time. But anyways, that's what the SOA does. And
Can you just give a little background on the SOA? How long has it
been
there?
I don't know exactly what year it started, but it was originally in Panama.
48,
it started in Panama.
Okay.
And they threw them out. The Panamanian government didn't want them anymore, and they threw them out. And then they came to Georgia, so it must be a long time that they were in Georgia. 60s? Early 60s that they started there, training soldiers, you know. But anyways, the new name is the Western Hemisphere Institute for Strategic Cooperation, which is very hard to use as an acronym. And but it's WISC, and so we just call it the SOA clone, because we think nothing has changed. It's just a new name. But we at least got them to force them to make a new name. You know, and several times we were very close to closing it. The election was very close. The last time, as I think I mentioned yesterday, we would have had the votes to close it. And Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell and many generals and the Secretary of Defense all went around to Congress and got the congressmen to change their vote. So six people didn't show up for the vote who were going to vote to close it, and six others voted Not close it. So we lost 12 votes and we lost by 5 or 6 votes. So we would have closed the school, but it didn't happen because they wanted it. The Pentagon wanted it so badly that they reverted to these people. Well, anyways, then we were convicted and we were told to report to a certain prison at a certain time. You know, and I was, they were gracious enough to send me to Oxford, which is in the middle of Wisconsin, and at least Lucy could come up and visit, you know. And so I was glad of that. And I reported to the prison on August 7th, the year 2000. And the first thing you do when you walk in, you take everything you own away, if you brought anything, you know, except your glasses. They let you have your glasses, and I had my wedding ring on, and didn't make, take that. But everything else, and they box it up, and when you leave, you get it back. But they put you in this orange pumpkin suit. Have you ever seen, you've seen, all seen it in prison, you know, the orange suit, and you feel rather ridiculous because everybody knows you just came, you know, and you have to walk around for several days. And then they gave me some soft shoes, not shoes, but slippers, in which you couldn't go outside in. And so I couldn't go outside for the recreation time. And it took them 3 weeks to get me a pair of shoes that fit, you know, and I bought some of these. And we all had uniforms, blue uniforms, and you didn't have to wear them after 4 o'clock. But up till then, you always had to. If you came to the meals without proper attire, you couldn't eat. So I'm not talking again. I want to stress, I'm not talking about Shawshank. This is a minimum security. Nobody beats you. And I know people, we visit quite a few people. I have visited at least in 3 maximum security prisons in Wisconsin. I can talk a little bit about how difficult it is, and I will tomorrow when we talk about reforming the system. But while it isn't Shawshank, and it isn't brutal, it is malevolent. Once you go in that door, there's an attitude by the guards that you are nothing. You're just nothing, and they try to convince you that you're nothing. And some of the things that are very, very difficult while you're in prison is, first of all, the demeanor of the guards, who try to, they call you scum in a way, you know, that's what they're saying. The separation and loneliness. Some people never get a visit. They never get a letter. They're in this place, and that's the same thing. The maximum security is right next to the minimum security. The same thing happens, and these guards are rotated through the two prisons. Sleeping is very difficult. I'm a very light sleeper, and noise goes on till 1 o'clock, and talking and yelling in the hallways. We were not in a locked. We were four men in a bunk bed here and a bunk bed here, and then two lockers there, and a small desk, and that was it. And there was no door, you know, so we could walk, and you could literally walk out of that prison, you know. But if you walked out of there and you got caught, which would be inevitable, you'd then go to maximum security and with a larger sentence, you know. So no, only one person who was a little bit off his, you know, he wasn't too with it. He tried to escape. He was the only one. And he stole a car, etc., etc. So he got a long sentence, you know, for all the things he did. But never happened since, again, that anybody did that. Well, my personal life in prison was very focused. And I must say, in my whole life, I have never had as an intentional, and you spoke about this morning, as such an intentional spiritual life. We had Bible class every morning at 8 o'clock, and I wish I could go into detail, and I have a whole lesson on spirituality in prison. I think it's really wonderful. I don't have time because I want to get back to the reform next time. But it really was a lot of people come from a background of religiosity, but they haven't practiced it, and others come for the first time and meet their God. For the first time. And I talk a little bit about this in my spirituality thing, is that, you know, visiting prisoner is one of the calls in Matthew as far as judgment. We are going to be judged as if we are people who visit prisons, because they asked, when did we not visit you in prison or something, you know, and why didn't we, of course, I think feeding people and giving them water and some hospitality and so forth, we do rather well. The church does too. But we don't do a whole lot of visiting of prisoners. I think it's almost, I think you could And I don't know how many people in this room have ever visited a prison to visit a prisoner. Some people go on tours and so forth. But basically, and I must say, again, this is not in a judgmental way, but unfortunately, Lutherans don't do a very good job. Other churches are much more. And you know who the largest contingent in prisons is? The Muslims. You know, they have, see, they don't have pastors and have to come and visit them. They can preach on their own, and most of the individual people of Islam preach on their own. They always have a large group in every prison. Well, Malcolm X is an example of this change become. So anyways, what I did, I first of all, I pledged I would not take any snacks. We had three meals. I would not eat anything else besides that. And the way that worked, we had breakfast at 6, lunch at 11, and 3:30 we had supper. So at 4 o'clock, there was no more food if you were doing what I was doing. So, but I pledged that, and I pledged not to take a nap. No matter how tired I would not take a nap, and I was very focused. I received and answered 350 letters. I got letters from all over the world. I got some from Belgium, a nun there who has said her group is praying for me every day, and the other nine also, you know. And I also kept a daily journal, which ended up about 200-some typewritten pages. And I was told, don't keep that in your locker, because I was viewing what I was viewing and writing about it, the way the guards acted. And he says, they're going to find that, they're going to be in trouble, you know. So I sent it home, and it was like a letter to, they do not read your letters if you send it home, at least they told us they didn't. But I would send it home every night. And that's all I bought at the commissary was stamps, because I used a lot of stamps for the 350 letters, and then also to send Lucy something every night. But I did a lot of reading in the library, and I said that we also had evening Bible classes at different times. And when people would come in, I remember the Baptist person came in and talked. And I also, everybody has to do some kind of labor. And I taught GED. And I want to tell you about a little fraud that happened over that. We taught for 3 hours in the afternoon from like 1 to 4. But they said you have to claim 8 hours. Now I imagine that has something to do with their budget and what they get from the government to take care of their institution. I said, I can't do that. That's a fraud. He said, well, you better, or you're gonna answer to all these other guys who have already done it, you know. So I went along with it, and I put in 8 hours, you know, and I was only working 3. But I guess that was for all the people who were employed, you know, and most of them only had just 3 or 4 hours of work a day. So let me say that healthcare is absolutely almost missing. They do have some people who are supposedly there to help your health. I'll give you one example, and there were many more I could tell you about, of how poorly they took care of people. We had a man, he was in his 50s, and he had a heart attack. He went to the hospital, they gave him a bypass, quadruple bypass. 4 days later, he had to go back into prison and go in his cell. And you know, that's not a place where you're gonna heal very well. And they gave him a wheelchair, and he had to wheel himself to lunch, you know, and he sat there on the end of the table, and he was yellow, and he was fatigued. He could hardly get the spoon to his mouth. I said, that man is not long for this world. I said, why don't somebody take care of him? Sure enough, the next day he started to hemorrhage from his mouth and nose, and he was bleeding all over the place, and they rushed him to the hospital. I never found out what had happened to him. But such a bad way of treating people who are ill. There's a lot of people in prisons. Of course, now the Supreme Court has judged that you can't send a person to death row who has a mental illness. I guess that was at least a small success. But we have a lot of people in prisons who are mentally ill, and they don't belong there. They are. I talked with one for a great. When somebody told me, why don't you talk to him? I was a pharmacist, and he thought I could maybe help him. He was so far gone, and he'd been there 3 years, and he had another 4 years. But there's that kind of thing just does not exist in prison. I could give you a lot more examples, but that are almost as horrible as a man coming back from quadruple bypass. But I'll keep going. We had 180 brothers in the minimum security. Almost half were white, and almost half were people of color, which is very unusual. Most of the prisons are 85%. Mostly Afro-Americans. And of those, most of the people who were Afro-American and some of the people who were white were there for drug problems. Mm-hmm. Almost all the whites were there for fraud. And we had 20 lawyers who had they did a little twiddling with the stuff when they made their contracts and so forth. For 20 of them, there were lawyers, there were people who were real estate agents, and many of these came from Chicago and Illinois, because that was the closest federal prison, and more came from there. One little anecdote, I don't have many funny things to tell you about prison or the SOA, but they did have two men there, a father and son, who were at Oxford. And they were there they were a big contractor, and this was probably not a mafia, what do you call it, organized crime group, And they made roads that started to curl up after a while, and they were indicted for fraud and sent to Oxford, both of them, One was there longer, one was there when I was there. I think the father was still there, the son had gone home. But they got a fine for what they did, plus the prison. And the fine was $42 million. Oh. And they paid it in cash.
Oh. Mm.
This was in the paper, so it's not something that somebody made up. And all the kids and all the guys from Chicago knew that this, they knew these guys, and they had read about them and everything. But they paid in cash. So I imagine they had a few, maybe another 10 bucks in the kitty that they hadn't, above the fine. But anyways, and there were two mayors of two towns in Illinois. There was three aldermen, two of them from Chicago. There was Rostenkowski, I don't know if you remember Rostenkowski. He went to Oxford for his crime of, and he was a congressman who was found to be defrauding the government. And there were just a lot of people who had positions of status, who did something wrong. And I talked to a lot of lawyers, and one guy, all of them said I had plenty of money. I was doing real well, but I wanted more. That isn't that a common thing? You start making some money, but you want more. So, anyways, that was the setup at Oxford, And like I said, I had three roommates who were Afro Americans, and immediately when they heard I was going to be in there, a lot of white guys came up and in my ear, they said, "You better get a transfer. You're never going to live in there with those three guys. You're never going to make it. Get out of there as soon as you can. Transfer out." They were the nicest three guys you could probably want to know. I mean, they were criminals. They were felons. They had done something. One did it with a gun. Even he was there for 8 years, and he had been in Chicago in prison. One was Cortez, and one was Steve, and one was BJ. And they were very good to me. Well, I was the oldest guy in the prison, so I was Mr. Fisher to everybody. Nobody called me Gerhardt, I was Mr. Fisher. And one other man was also my age, and his name was Seward. Anybody got any recollection of your history? Who was Seward?
Here's the he's the Exxon Valdez captain.
What?
Exxon Valdez?
No, Seward. No, he was the Secretary of State who bought Alaska. He didn't buy it, but he signed the check. And this great-great-great-grandson of his had it at home, and had a copy of the check, for I don't know how many millions it was, 11 million or something. But he was the only other person that approached me in age. But I was 71 at the time. And, I don't want to be pretentious and say, but I believe I was called to be at Oxford and experience the prisons. Because I read tons of books, and I we visit people in the maximum security. We hear all the stories. What you see in Shawshank does exist in the maximum security prison. How many people here have a supermax in their state?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
Washington.
You have? Well, yeah, we're from Wisconsin. We have one, and that's something that I think is demonic. I don't know if you know much about supermaxes, but their cells are probably from here to the wall, and about that wide. You could probably put your arms across. They have a slab in this corner, and they have a thin mattress where you sleep. The light is always on. There's a TV that watches you day and night. When you do have visitors, you go in a room, and they do it through television. You view your person through television. You stay in there 24 hours every day, except 3 days you're allowed 1 hour out for recreation. And recreation is walking down a little ways, and there's a room probably this big. And it's four concrete walls with no equipment or anything, but you can walk in a circle in there. That's about all you can do. There's no heat in that room. It's very hot in summer and very cold in winter. And the cells are also. And of course, there's no air conditioning in any cell that I know of, in any prison that I know of. But that's how. And their meals are shoved through a slot. They never converse with anybody. They never be able to talk to anybody. Just think, you can spend up to 2 years in class one, and then you can grow up to class two, where you might get a little something to read. They have nothing to read. They don't even get a Bible to read. Nothing to do. They can sit there and lay there all day long, and the next day is just like the first day, and the third day is just like the first day, and it goes on and on, and this is called Supermax. And we have we had a suit. Ones who do these kind of things.
ACLU.
Yeah, ACLU had their best lawyer up there in Madison, you know. And they sued that it was a cruel and unusual punishment that these people were receiving. And Judge Crabb, the federal judge, agreed with them, and they got a few things. The light doesn't have to stay on all the time. They got more blankets because they only had one blanket, no matter how cold it got. Things like that. They were allowed to have reading material, especially Bibles, etc., etc. So if you had a few concessions, not a whole lot. Barbara Crabb, who was the judge, said, "This is only the beginning. We got to come back to this and find out what we really have to do for these prisoners." And of course, they banned all people with mental problems, you know, mental illness. And she ruled that nobody could come to a Supermax who had mental illness. And there were some, there were six that were then removed. Can you imagine with a mental problem, they put you in a cell and you're there for all by yourself, you know, for 2 years, you know. And legislators who said this was mollycoddling, that they granted these little things, you know. A friend of mine who was a mayor of Milwaukee for many years, he said we ought to take a bulldozer up there and rip it apart, you know, because it's such a draconian thing. I mean, to think that you put people, I don't care what they did, these were not all people who were. See, it was supposed to be for those prisoners who couldn't be handled in a maximum security, who caused trouble, et cetera, et cetera. Some people said there probably is 25 of those in the state prison system. So they built this Supermax holds 500 prisoners. Guess who's going to go there? It's not going to be the incorrigibles. Anybody, you're not going to leave. They finally got 300 prisoners there. Many of them are not incorrigible and shouldn't be there in the first place. But they're going to fill it. You know, their beds are, there's 200 beds left. They're going to find people to put in there, you know. And I think, and what do you personally, just off the top of your head, what do you think about something like that? And do you, maybe you don't even know you have one in your state, because they're Texas has two or three, you know, and they've been around for a long time. What do you think? Anybody want to make a comment? Are you in favor of that? Would you like to see them closed?
I'm coming off seeing programs on television where there's country club style living in the prisons.
Yeah.
So this is like, whoa.
Well, where, what prison was that, by the way?
I don't remember, but yeah. I mean, there have been several exposés.
Yeah, exposés. We had a track you could walk around, and we had a tennis court, which wasn't used very often, you know, because you weren't allowed to. If you came on the day when they said, okay, you can play tennis, and you came and you took a picture of that, you say, oh my gosh, these guys play tennis, you know. Believe me, I don't know where these places are. There probably some exist. Of course, this is a federal prison. Now, there are state prisons that are maybe better, you know, as far as what you were saying, you know. They were probably, they certainly weren't a federal prison. But maybe there were some prisons where, you know, some of the people from Watergate and so forth, they went to those too, and they said, oh, they had it real nice, you know. Let me tell you one thing about you can get anything you want in prison if you have the money. Mm-hmm. You can get any drug you want.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say it's the prisoners who run the prisons and not the guards, because that's a hell of a job, I'll tell you, to be a guard. You know, at Oxford, if you were a guard, and that pertains to those in the maximum also, it took 2 years before you got a Sunday off. It took another 3 years before you got a weekend off. It was all by, you know, first come, first serve. And that's how it took 5 years before you could have a weekend off with your family. You know, And they're doing, you know, they're existing in a situation of abuse and so forth. That's got to be taxing on them. That's got to influence their life to be a guard, you know. And they're expected to be abusive. You know, I don't mean abusive with slapping you or hitting you with a truncheon or anything. But they were expected to be, even in a minimum security, they were expected to be abusive. And they change the rules constantly. I mean, for a long time, if you were working in the kitchen, you could shower like at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, because after you were done setting things up for breakfast and so forth, you could shower. Then they decided, no, nobody can shower in the morning. And these guys come out greasy and everything, and they couldn't shower till 9 o'clock or something, you know. And stuff like that, you know, it just goes on constantly, changing the rules. And we had at least 6 to 8 people who went in the hole. And the hole was in the maximum security prison. You went down there. And it was varied reasons, you know. And many of them were, I thought, rather unjust, you know. And they'd get 60 days in the hole, you know. And it was the hole in the maximum security prison. Yes, ma'am.
I have taught corrections over time. And it's my experience that federal prisons are the nicest.
Well, that's not what people tell me. You may have that experience, yeah.
No, what I'm saying to you is that if your experience was horrible in federal prisons, it's typically worse.
Oh, yeah. I would agree. The worst places are jails.
County, they're not paid as well. They don't have as much money to take care of the federal, at the state prisons. Yeah. And they don't have as many federal regulations.
That's so possible. You may know more about that
worse.
Than I do.
It's even worse.
Yeah. And the worst are jails.
Yep.
You know, jails are slovenly, dirty, and many times. And many of those people there are waiting to go on trial. They may be innocent. And have you read lately, this has nothing to do with this, but that 101 person now have left death row because of DNA. You just read it? Did you read it? Just a couple weeks ago, maybe more by now. 101 people have left death row because they were innocent. One man left death row, I think, 24 hours before he was going to be killed, and it was started by some students at Northwestern. I understand it was they started professors and the students started to research some of this stuff, and it became and now Wisconsin has a Innocence Project and et cetera, and so on. You know, yeah. The time is up, so if you want to leave, it's okay. You know, unless somebody has a question yet or something. There are some things there. Did you put out any of my? I did a report, and if you take it. Please read it. If you agree with it, pass it on to somebody. I think I spent a lot of time on it. Our synod was good enough to print 250 of them. I do a lot of speaking. And so it's a report that the title is The Moral, Humanitarian, and Fiscal Necessity of Reforming Our Criminal Justice System, Especially the Prison Institution. And tomorrow I will talk about why I believe it needs reform, and I also, especially prisons, I think they've been called the most brutal in the Western world, our prisons. Okay. I'll see you tomorrow.